On this episode of the Writing Fright podcast, I am joined by award-winning indie author RJ Lewis. We're going to cover a lot in this episode, and you are not going to want to miss it. Keep in mind, we are not attorneys. We cannot give legal advice. We are also not accountants. So before you put anything into practice as far as business structure or some of the other things that are talked about in this episode, please consult with your attorney. Please consult with your accountant to find out what is the best business practice for you. With that said, yes, we are getting into the business of publishing your indie books. We are getting into structure. We are getting into copywriting and writing the ads and the stuff that gets eyeballs on your work. We're also going to talk about why it's a good idea to have an editor, how to use your beta readers, and putting together a launch team. There's a lot that we are going to cover in this episode, so stay tuned. Welcome back to the Writing Fright podcast. I am your host and fellow writer, Tanner Rutledge. I am joined here virtually by RJ Lewis, actor, magician, and multi-award-winning indie author, and the author of The Muse, which in and of itself has won 14 indie publishing awards. Welcome to the studio.
Oh, it's really a pleasure to be here, Tanner. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, thank you for coming on. Indie publishing is something that I've been wanting to shine a light on for a while. It's a route that I'm looking at going at myself. Several authors have done this as a career and as a way to prove their concept, prove their talent to get bigger traditional contracts down the road. And whenever I see somebody doing it right, I absolutely just want to get in and see what happens. So starting at the beginning, what got you into writing?
Well, I've been writing most of my life. I have to be honest. I wrote puppet shows when I was about 16 years old. I went on to write screenplays and things like that. And plus two of my closest friends, writers Marvin Kaye and Park Godwin, who made their living being writers. And one of the most famous things they wrote was the science fiction novel, The Masters of Solitude. And they kind of inspired me because I saw them writing and it was a regular part of their life. So I started writing short stories and then was really surprised when they sold. I ended up selling short stories to, and this is back in the 90s, so magazines were still a thing then, but I sold to H.P. Lovecraft Magazine of Horror, and I sold to Weird Tales and all these things. So then I made the commitment and I said, well, you know, I have these ideas for novels running around in my head. It's time to write them down. So I started writing. First book I wrote was a story called Messiah. You'll notice that it's not one of the books I have for sale. And there's a reason for that. It was terrible. I really was awful, but I learned and I kept writing and like any other craft, no matter how good your imagination is, you have to learn the craft. You have to learn how to structure a story so that it really resonates and works. I mean, The Muse is a very good example. I originally wrote that in the 90s. I started writing that in early 2000 and I rewrote it 5 or 6 times before it ended up going to an editor and then being published.
That's fantastic. Now, when you published The Muse, did you indie publish that or was it through an indie press or cool?
Yes, I published it. I have my entertainment company is a 501c3, which doesn't mean I don't get paid. It means I'm an employee of the corporation. Mm-hmm. And since it's arts-based, it made sense to make it a 501c3. And publishing is also covered by 501c3. So I got a doing business as for the corporation and created Mindbender Press, which is my own label. And I started releasing things through the corporation. That's fantastic. It just makes bookkeeping much, much easier to do that.
I'm actually looking at doing something very similar with Writing Fright Press to get out some of my work and some other authors for some anthologies and things down the road. So that's exciting to hear that it's worked for you.
A very good idea. Yes, it works for me. And quite honestly, there's a little more paperwork involved, but a 501c3 is your best as far as taxes and things, is just a really convenient way. And since it's arts based, which publishing is, it's not, you're not pulling something, you're not doing a fast one. It's perfectly legal, and it does just make bookkeeping a lot easier.
That is fantastic. I actually just wrote that down for to look into after the podcast. I appreciate
LLCs. That. Most people are going with LLCs, but I have to tell you, I think the 501c3 is a better choice.
Neat. Yeah. So that was what I was going to do, a single member LLC, just to establish it. But yeah, I will definitely look into that. Now, when you were getting going, when you wrote The Muse, when you did your first novel, what kind of things did you do to learn how to structure the story and how to actually structure a cohesive novel?
Well, the best way is the one recommended by Stephen King in his book On Writing. You read a lot and you write a lot, and you keep going over the book. And when you grimace at parts of it, you know it's not ready yet. You really should feel the flow. Like when, and you know, read the best writers in your genre. I mean, my major genre is paranormal and horror. So what do I read? I read Stephen King. I read Dean Koontz. For general writing, I read John D. MacDonald, although some of his books are dated. The writing is just so amazing and beautiful, and he just does such a great job. So you read the best in your field. And also, it doesn't hurt to read really not the best in your field. Read some really bad stuff and go, okay, I don't want to do that. No, that's not something I want to do. And by writing and reading pretty much every day, I write every day. So by doing it every day, you improve as an artist, and then get people to give you feedback. Don't be afraid to show your work, and don't be afraid to hear, you know, this really sucks. Because, okay, you didn't like it. What specifically didn't you like? So you can learn to improve whatever your failings, because we all have failings. You have to learn what your failing is so you can improve it. Absolutely. My biggest failing is give up. He gave a wink. He gave a nod. He gave a shake. I mean, this is the number one thing my wife looks for, because she's my first beta reader. It goes, you got to cut out with the givers. And that's one of my bad habits, and I'm finally learning to conquer it.
I get that. When I started writing, I took a couple of college courses and things way back when I was in college, just because I loved it and did it since I was a kid. And feedback, getting past it sucked. Okay. What was it? The dialogue? Was it clunky?
Yes.
It leads you somewhere like, where it exactly sucked, so I can fix it. I think that's the best way to grow a thick skin too, because then it doesn't become about you personally. You don't suck. You did something that didn't work, and you're going to fix it. So I think that's a good mindset thing that helps people get past getting stuck in their own shells.
Yes. It's very easy to do, because, you know, I've gotten some bad reviews. Fortunately, most of my bad reviews were where you read them and go, oh, sure. Like one said, this book has words in it I've never seen before. Oh, I'm sorry I used a thesaurus. Apologize for that. You know, another one was, well, I downloaded it, but I haven't read it yet. And so you leave me a 1-star review. It's like, what? But that's what happens.
I read through their 1-star review, especially in horror. People will, they'll get a horror book, and then they'll complain about certain things that are genre tropes, or certain things that are just going to happen in this type of literature and in this genre period. So just I tend to ignore 1-star reviews and not necessarily in writing, but when it comes to podcasting, when it comes to things that I have published and put out, unless there is something in there that I can take from it, I'm just not going to listen to it.
Yeah. But and that's really the best thing. That really is.
And getting into the reviews. Oh, go ahead.
Didn't no, please. Going to talk about horror tropes, but I'll let you guide me.
getting into, and we'll circle back to horror tropes and the genre in particular, but jumping off of the reviews, your copy, and when I was going through and I was looking at your books and the products that the art that you produce, these covers, they look professionally done. I couldn't tell a difference between the copy, the blurbs, and all of the basically the sales print on your Amazon and a larger press. This is fantastic. One of the major things that indie authors I've noticed, their books will be fantastic. Their blurbs and their copy is really bad. So if you don't mind walking us through, how do you package your books once you get them finished and ready to go to market?
Well, the number one thing to do, and this is what I've done since I've been publishing since 2017, is you assemble a team of creative people to work with you. I'm very fortunate to have Marianne Nowicki, who runs the pre-made ebook cover shop.com. She does pre-made books, but she also does custom designs. And she's been designing all of my books for me. She's really just a brilliant artist. And not only that, she knows the market for each genre. She's really studied it. She's just very knowledgeable. And a lot of the covers have artwork that I've found on Shutterstock or one of the major things and suggested to her. And then some of them, she saw my suggestions and came up with something that different that was better. And I, you know, went, oh, this is really much better. So the point is, she's a great person to have on your team. And there are great people out there. You can even find some on Fiverr that do some really nice work. But the point is, find somebody who does your genre very well and then stick with them. Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid to take suggestions. The important thing is find somebody you can work with who hears your ideas and hears your things and then can build on that. And that's what I feel I really have with Marianne. She's just really, really brilliant. As far as the blurb copy, which, and again, your three major things. If for your book selling are your cover, your blurb, and your keywords. Those are the three most important things. Keywords you can get from something like Publisher Rocket. If people don't know about that, that's a very useful tool for getting keywords for advertising and for books. As far as the cover blurb, some of my blurbs have been written by Brian Cohen, who has Best Page Forward, and he charges to write blurbs. And hiring him to do my early blurbs was a great idea because I learned the formula that he uses. And this formula has been talked about. I'm a member of a mastermind. And we talk about the formula you use, which is called AIDA, like the opera. And let me break that down for you. AIDA breaks down to A, attention. You need an opening line that gets your audience's attention. The next one is interest. Interest, you then want to write copy that gets them interested in the book. Okay. D, that's for desire. The copy towards the end should be to make them want to buy the book. And then the other A, attention, interest, desire, and action. So your last line is buy the book or buy the book today and read about this amazing hero or get a case of paranormal mystery fever tonight. I mean, that's the one I use for infection in the mind. But you want that final line to be get it, buy it, do it, take action. So that's how you break it down. Attention, interest, desire, and action. And that's what a good blurb should have. In about five at the most paragraphs. You don't want to tell them the entire story. You just want to entice them. You want to give them the sizzle so that they want to get the steak.
It works, man. I was going through when I found you and I was looking through your books for something to read. There were like four or five that jumped out that I'm like, I got to buy that. Yeah, that looks great. And it's I'm also a copywriter, so I have a little bit of background in sales and marketing. And
so you know this better than I do, actually.
Well, a little bit, like for different industries, not necessarily for literature and for genre writing. But if you guys out there, listeners, are interested in copywriting and you're interested specifically in what RJ just said, there's a book. It's the Copywriter's Handbook, this big yellow book. Just about every mastermind on the planet has people go through and read that, or at least takes the different pieces out for worksheets and workbooks. Get that, read that, and learn how to write a good blurb and sales copy.
Very, very important.
Now we've covered the business, and this was more than I thought we would get into with getting into the actual mechanics of writing a blurb and setting up your business for art and for a publishing company. Let's bring it back to the genre and to your works. You were going to talk about some tropes. What is your favorite trope in horror to write to?
Well, the thing with horror is you need to have the tropes that people expect. You need to bring in things that they expect. You have to have the scares. You have to have the you know, as Stephen King says, if I can't scare you, then I'll gross you out. And my current book that I'm working on right now, Digger, I've really embraced that. I have a scene in a New Orleans cemetery where the lead character who's is trying to subdue a voodoo priestess. And she does this thing. And I don't know if you've been to New Orleans, but they have these water bugs that when you go walking on the sidewalk at night, they'll run out in front of you and you can't avoid stepping on them and crunching them. I have this scene where the character is attacked by all of these water bugs crawling up and over him and into his mouth and every, and it's truly one of the most disgusting scenes I ever wrote. And just, I just thinking about it makes chills go up my own spine. But, you know, that's a horror thing going on, and it's very visceral and affects people. But the number one thing, and this is the biggest problem I see with horror, the biggest problem is it's always about character. And that's the mistake many writers make. It's always about the character. It's always about getting the reader involved in what the characters are experiencing so that they identify with the character and they feel the experience along with them. Because if you don't have that, you can have the buckets of blood, you can have the horror, you can have the vampire swoop down from wherever, but it won't pull them in. And that's the number one thing that I recommend to anybody who wants to write in the genre of horror.
That really stands out in your work too. The muse, I was really pulled along. What kept me in the story was specifically Neil's journey. My background, I was an investigator for 15 years. So him going through that, and it really pulled me along in the story and his experiences. You do that very well. Also, the muse was an interesting read. It's almost a genre blend, and it takes, I think, something that you did really well, that people make a mistake when they write a trope, or when they're in horror and there's certain things that are expected, they'll stick hard to a trope that's known. They'll do vampires over and over and again. They'll do werewolves over and over again. I think something that you did really, really well in the muse, and I'm not going to get too into it because I don't want spoilers. You took elements of a couple of different tropes that were the scariest parts of those tropes and that were the most primal parts of those tropes and blended them together really well into a story that is your own thing. So you don't really know what to expect when you're going through this. And I thought that was really well. There's like two or three that when I was going through here, distinct, I want to say proto monsters or proto creatures or something that I saw and was like, oh man, that just came together really, really well. So I like
inventing new monsters. Yep. That's, and you know, with the muse, I love telling the story because, you know, the number one question people ask writers is, well, how do you come up with your ideas? I think with a lot of us, it's like, how do you get your ideas under control? Because you always got new ones coming. But I can remember when I got the idea for the muse very easily. It was June 19th of 1999. And there's a reason I can remember that date. I decided to write my first horror story in 1999, and it was called The Dark. And it was about a night guard who worked the night shift, and there were actual creatures in the dark. And that ended up becoming a whole novel later on. It became Kept in the Dark and became a much more interesting story, taking 50 years of history in with it. But the day after I wrote that short story, I heard that Stephen King got hit by a truck. And that's why I know what the date is, because I you can look it up. And I had the weirdest idea, and the weird idea was, you know, it's like something wanted that story written and he couldn't do it. So it went to me. Now, it's of course, you know, all ego, because, you know, he's a much, much more famous and better writer than I am. But the idea stuck with me. What if there was a thing, an actual entity that could help you write, and not just write, but write really well and really fast? And that became the whole idea of the muse, and I'm very, very proud of it. It's a fun ride. It's of my current writing, it's the one I call my Dean Koontz tribute, because it's very, very Dean Koontz, if you think about it, as the one I'm working on right now, which is Digger, about a grave digger who actually gets called in when the dead won't stay buried. This is much more Stephen King. This is kind of my Stephen King tribute. So it's interesting how the stories develop and grow and pull you in different ways.
That's interesting that you said Dean Koontz. I thought the same thing when I was reading through it. I was like, this feels Koontz-ish, but there's a couple of things in the copy on your work that describe your writing as kind of a blend of Stephen King and Richard Layman, two completely different styles. But I absolutely see that. And that's super interesting that you brought up.
He's one of my favorite writers. Yeah. I love even the stuff. And lately I've been reading some of his earlier stuff. And even that, it's just you can see, and he has such a beautiful turn of phrase and things. These are the things I want to improve in my work, is these beautiful images that he creates with words that I would love to do more of. And, you know, as I grow as an artist, my own style develops, but I want it to improve so I can put out the best product I can at all times.
And the novel you mentioned, was it Kept in the Dark?
Yes.
That one is also on my list. That looked like a really interesting read. And going through, and something that I really enjoyed about once I found indie authors and started reading more and more indie horror, is the progression from novel to novel. So in traditional publishing, you have like 6-7 rounds of rounds of editing, and like there's so many people touching that book. And you can still see progressions. One of my favorite authors was Michael McDowell, and he did the Elementals, and you can see a massive explosion of growth between Amulet and Elementals in his writing style. With indies, those of us that do hire editors, we go through with what we can afford. Maybe one round of developmental editors, possibly some line editing and proofreading. So you get a bit more of a raw look at the author's talent, and you can see from book to book how much better that author gets throughout their career. You get 20 books in on an indie author, and the work is amazing, especially if you read that first novel and you read that 20th novel.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite things about indie fiction.
Well, you know, the other thing is with that is finding the right editor. I had an editor who just basically corrected my mistakes. And I recently hooked up with a new editor who just gets in there and kicks my rear end. I mean, she is not holding back. She tells me exactly, you got to stop this, and this doesn't work for me, and da da da. But everything she points out, I'm like, oh yeah, she's right. Everything I read it and I go, oh yeah, that is better. Oh yeah, I could do that. So, you know, find an editor who challenges you. If your editor isn't challenging you, you need a new editor.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the development editing. And I use the same editor for the line edit. So it's great because she gets to see after I take her suggestions in. And goes, okay, you did it. You committed to the suggestions, and I really like the finished product. So it's you know, it's a good thing to have somebody, again, another important member of your team.
That's fantastic. I haven't seen any developmental editors that also went through and did line editing as I've been shopping for someone good to come in to look at my stuff before it comes out. But something that I have looked at, if you have a developmental editor that is not going through for a line read, some authors that I've talked to have had luck with giving them an editing credit in the book or a further mention in the book, if they'll just read through it and approve it. Like you send your draft in, hey, would you check this out? If you approve this, if you like what it is and it's ready to go, we'll give you a little bit extra credit in the book. And that's worked for several.
Sounds like a very good idea. You know, we're always crunching the numbers.
Yeah.
We're a slave to the numbers. We gotta make a profit with the book. I mean, that's what it boils down to.
Yeah. And it is a business.
Yes. Exactly. It's very much a business, and learning. You have to learn the business like you learn any other business. It's like opening a shop downtown. You gotta learn it, and there's no other way to do it.
Now, with getting into to opening your own press and you're basically what comes down to like a media company, Was there anything that you reached out to learn how to run that business, or is this knowledge that you brought in from being a magician, being a performer, and being in business for yourself for so long?
I started the corporation in 1997, and it was because of a very simple reason. In the state of New Jersey, if you own a corporation, you have to pay the state $1,000 a year just to have a corporation, unless it's a nonprofit corporation. Now, I had a regular corporation, and then I started a nonprofit corporation and moved everything into the nonprofit. But the nonprofit, I don't have to pay the state this fee every year. I don't even have to file state income taxes. I only have to file federal ones. So it made a very logical choice. Now, the downside is anything owned by the corporation, if you dissolve a nonprofit corporation, must be given to another nonprofit corporation, or you can sell it before you close the business. But the point is, you're supposed to donate other things to another nonprofit. And I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm done with a regular corporation, the point of it is simple. When you're done with it, you want to sell it to somebody else. That's what a regular corporation is for. With an art corporation, publishing or any of this, when I'm done, I'm just done. There's nothing that I want to sell. You know, the books, if I can sell the books, I'll sell the individual books. But I personally own the books. The corporation doesn't own them. It's just the money from them funnels through it. So, yeah, it's set up really. I maintain the rights to the books, but I have the sales go through the corporation. So it just makes bookkeeping very simple.
So you personally, you don't just own the copyright and the rights to the IP. You have personal ownership over publishing rights too. That did not go to your corporation.
Right. It did not go to the corporation. The corporation is merely publishing it on the concept of making, you know, bringing in money to the nonprofit corporation.
Got it.
And I've been doing that since 1997. So I had a lot of experience handling it. And the corporation also covers my wife's dance studio because, again, it's the arts. So we've got my entertainment. I'm still a performing magician. I did 50 camp shows this summer. My wife has her dance studio and we have the publishing, and it's all covered by the corporation.
That's fantastic. So I'm looking at doing the same thing with the podcast. I'm looking at launching an actual print magazine. It'll start off as an e-magazine with Writing Fright and then doing the publication. So I'm looking at doing something very, very similar to that. So that's interesting.
It's a good way to go because it also the liability and workers' comp and all of those things. I don't know what the laws are where you are, but I have my corporation. I'm required to have workman's comp because I'm in the state of New Jersey. But since I'm going through the workman's comp now as a publisher, it's much less expensive than it was when it was focused on being a performer. That the workers' comp was very high. Now the workers' comp is very low. So it's working out really well for me.
That's interesting. And that's going to vary from state to state, but we're very similar to New Jersey as far as our laws about incorporating and insurance needs. But getting back into actually making books and being in multiple markets, you are a performer. And one thing that I noticed with Muse, so I read this book, a combination of actually reading the text and listening to the audiobook. I had a massive surveillance case come in, so I ended up sitting in the car listening to this on surveillance for a while. Now, you actually did the audiobook and recorded the audiobook here.
Yes, I did.
A big thing that I hear a lot about why people are slow to get into indie publishing is because they want to be on Audible. They want to have an audiobook. How did you create the audiobook? How did you go about recording it and getting it out there on Amazon?
Well, I have a lovely little thing. It's called a Vogo. It's called a Vocal Booth to Go. And this is this thing that folds flat and then opens up to be this shell. And you put a cloth behind you and it makes this little sound booth that you can work in. And it cuts out outside noises really, really excellently. Also, I'm using the microphone I recorded the Muse on right now in front of me. good set of headphones, a really good microphone, very, very important. And practice reading aloud, practice hearing what your characters sound like. One of the things I'm going to be working on this fall is I'm going to be working on the audiobooks for The Wizards of Central Park West. And in that one, I have an old man wizard called Marlowe, and I've got a younger, very self-important wizard. And I can not only do the voices, but I can borrow the voices if I wish to. You know, we like Marlowe is an old man who's talking like this, and he sounds this. And then Drusillicus, who's the very haughty fellow, well, I can just make him sound like Snape if I wish. So, Eddie, I suppose you must do that, don't you? Now, don't give him a hard time. He's trying to learn as fast as he can. So, you know, practice the voices, play with the voices. You'll make mistakes. If you make a mistake, just re-record a segment and then fix it in the editing.
Have you done the voices for all of your books?
No, because The Vanishing is the lead character is a woman. And when you have a lead character as a woman, people expect the audiobook to be recorded by a woman. So I went up on Audible and I auditioned people. And I hired a very, very talented woman to record it for me. Let me just, there we go. Fadra Nalia, which is why I had to look up the name because I don't want to mispronounce it. But Phaedra Nally, that's her name. And she recorded The Vanishing for me, did a bang up job because The Vanishing has a lot of ancient Indian lore in it. So it actually has some of the Native American languages. And she was able to learn them and master them and roll them off of her tongue without any problem. And I hired her through Audible and she created a really beautiful audiobook for me. And I'm very pleased with it.
That's fantastic. There's several options out there for people to do audiobooks. So that is not a reason to hold back and not launch this yourself.
Very true.
And if you haven't experienced one of his audiobooks, the Muse was great. It's almost like listening to an audio drama. The voices that you're able to do in there, it's done very well, very high quality recording.
Oh, thank you. You know, the point always is try to create the best quality you can in anything you try to do, but be willing to just put it out there. You know, you can drive yourself crazy trying to make it perfect. You're not going to make it perfect, but make it the best product you can with everything you do.
It's been that way in podcasting. When it comes to, like you were talking about that sound booth, I've looked at those. I've looked at getting those. This podcast that I'm recording on, the microphone that I'm using was about $100 along with a soundboard just to get this up and going. And then I paid, I think, altogether about $50 for soundproof panels to go along the inside of this room. To cut back on reverb. So
we're building a room up to an attic room in my house. And when I get that done, it's a tiny little room upstairs, but I'm planning to soundproof it and turn that into my real recording studio.
That's fantastic. It's nice to have one in your house, just for this. And I've got, for those of you that are looking for different revenue sources, I've had voice actors come over and record in here. You can, so if you're looking for, I would really like to have an editor, but I can't afford $1,700 for one read through right now. Mm. Well, bring somebody in and rent out some space or write some copy if you're comfortable doing that. But
there you go.
So thank you so much for coming on the show. You gave our audience here so much information as far as getting the product out there. There was one more thing that I wanted to mention. How many awards total have you won?
I found out yesterday, and I don't know if it's the full award, but I found out I hit my 35th yesterday.
Wow.
I'm a finalist for The Vanishing in the Page Turner Awards, which is an independent one. And I won't find out till October if I'm, you know, if I make it to the next thing will be the top 10. And then the final thing will be who won in that genre. And it's very, I have to tell you, being in the horror genre, which is what I tend to send out, it's very competitive, but it's very good because if you've got strong characters and a good story a lot of horror doesn't. And I'm not saying that to be mean. I'm just saying that a perfect example is I was neck and neck with this one guy and I read his book because I thought, oh, this will be great. And then at the end, it turned out the whole concept was this, the devil, a demon was disguised as this person and was killing people. And then at the end, one of the other people was actually an angel the whole time. And I wanted to throw the book aside. I went, you mean you let all the people die because you didn't want to reveal you were an angel? What? So that's the thing, be careful of. Make sure that your ending doesn't completely disregard everything that you've written until then. So just, yeah. And again, it helps if you can write really good characters and a really good story that at the end, people, the logic that you created, no matter how twisted, makes sense at the end. Very important.
Yeah, I've had a lot of stories where I got to the end of it and I was like, no, this is a better ending. But then you have to go back in revision. This is the part I think where a lot of authors miss. You have to go back in revision and put those little clues in there so that it's yes. a plausible ending. Why would he let everybody die? Maybe there's a rule that he can't interfere with certain deaths, or you pull like the Doctor Who thing where you have these events that are, what are they? Set points on the timeline that he can't interfere yes. with. You know, you have that in it built into
oh, your lore. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You're good. You just did yeah. that boom right off the top of your head. That's
well, that's
great.
A Doctor Who thing, but yeah.
Cause I, well, and I'm a big fan of Doctor Who. And so I knew exactly what you're talking about, but I just read the book and went, oh, I can't believe that. I didn't come up with solutions. That's really, wow.
But that's where an editor comes in. That's something that they would see. That's something beta readers would see. If you can't get an editor, we've talked about this on the podcast, we've talked about it with other people. Get a beta reader, get a second point of eyes on there that's going to look at it, because you might know the reason. You might have written the lore and you might know what's going on there. Your reader doesn't have a clue.
And you don't want a beta reader who goes, oh, that was really nice. I like that. No, thank you. Yep. I am so grateful to my beta readers because I create a launch team. My last launch team for The Vanishing was 100 people. This time with the next one, Digger, I'm probably going to go for 200 mm-hmm. because out of 100 people, I got 40 reviews the first day,
wow.
which is really, really a good turnaround. But I had some beta readers who I adore, who sent me sentences that had one word error. And you know, the biggest problem is then and than, or then and that, because you will miss that. Yep. Even if you use the trick I do, which is put on headphones and have your book read to you by your computer, one page at a time, that you'll really catch a lot. But those little tiny, and the beta readers pointed them out to me and I'm like, oh, I'm so grateful. Now I know I'll be going to print without these mistakes.
That's awesome. I love the tip that you said about having the computer read to you. For short stories that I'm sending out for submissions, I've tried the trick of sitting down and reading the story to myself, or reading the story out loud, recording it, and then listening to me read the story while I'm out driving around the car. As the person who wrote it, you're going to automatically fix those as you're reading through them. So those then and thans, you're going to fix that. Sentences that are clunky and weird, odd place commas, you're going to fix that. But having the computer read back to it, I love that. And I'm definitely going to start mm-hmm. doing that.
It's really good because you watch the page as you hear it mm-hmm. and you will actually go, oh, wait, that wasn't right. And then you'll be able to really focus in on things. And all computers now can do it. I mean, I own a Mac, so it just does it. But all computers can do that now.
Now, with Amuse, we spend a lot of time talking about that. You've got a re-release coming up on that, don't you?
Yes, I do. I had a new cover done, and I'm in the midst of finalizing a rewrite, where I just tightened things up, just went through and did a little bit of improvement. Because if I'm going to release it with a new cover, I want it to be as again, the best product I can put out. So I went through it and I rewrote stuff. I had an editor look at it and make suggestions. So I'm perfectly happy with what's out there now. But if I can make it a little bit better, then I'll make it. That's the joy of independent publishing, is that you can improve the product at any time. And that's the thing I like about it.
I love that. And especially like with it being an early work, learning how to write a novel and going through like the first episodes of this podcast are documenting me and how I learned how to write a novel, which is the one that I'm in revision right now. A year ago, I started writing. Today, going back and looking at what I wrote a year ago, holy crap, I am so much better within a year. So going back and doing that rewrite and tightening that up, that's massive. Writing from this was published in 2017 to what you are capable of today in your current works, a novel that's already great, gripping, fantastic characters going through and tightening that up, that's going to be phenomenal. I'll be looking for that re-release.
Well, you'll be able to tell because it'll have a new cover, and I'm planning to re-release it in October because scary books and Halloween just go together.
Awesome. When that comes out, I'll make sure that we pop that up on the social media and give it a shout out here on the podcast, because that's one people definitely need to read and need to check out.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
Oh, not a problem. So online and social media, where can people find you?
Well, first of all, it's very important that you know it's RJ Lewis spelled ARJAYLEWIS. The reason is I professionally, as a performer, used R period J period Lewis for 30, 40 years. But there's a R period J period Lewis who writes romances and is a USA bestseller. And I don't want you to confuse her with me, because even though I feel I had it first, but she got to prominence first. But she writes things very different from me, and nothing against any of her books. I've actually not read any, but mine is ARJAY Lewis. And you can find the website, which is ARJAY Lewis. I'm on Facebook as RJ Lewis, ARJAY Lewis, and ARJ Lewis Wright is RJ Lewis Wright on Twitter is my Twitter handle. So I'm there, and the trick would be, if you're looking for me, you can put in RJ Lewis and put the word in horror, and it should point you in my direction.
And guys, make sure to reach out on Amazon and follow him, so you know when the new releases come out, you know when news comes out. Thank you so much for stopping by the show. This was this was super informative for the listeners, and I learned so much from this 45-minute conversation.
If I can help someone not make the mistakes I did in the beginning, then it will be a wonderful thing.
All right. That wraps up another episode of Writing Fright Podcast. If you would like to interact with us outside of the show, check out our Instagram at Writing Fright. We're going to have some book reviews, some tips, and just some fun stuff that we put up there about writing. In 2 weeks, we will be back with our next episode and a sit down with Elsie Valentine, the author of The Last Girl Standing and The Last Girl Standing the Beginning. If you like the final girl trope, definitely an episode that you're going to want to tune into.